The History of Alternative Podcast. A historic look back at everything alternative.
Chicago's music scene in the 90s was magical. It was insane. It was unforgettable. After the Seattle scene exploded in the early 90s, Billboard magazine named Chicago the cutting edge's new capital, essentially making Chicago ground zero for big money record deals and can't miss club shows seemingly every night. The Billboard article pointed to artists like Smashing Pumpkins, Liz Phair, and Urge Overkill as proof of Chicago's musical strength. And in the years that followed, dozens of bands got swept up in the next big thing wave. Some bands made it farther than others, while many remained locally beloved, well-kept secrets. This is the History of Alternative Podcast. I'm James Van Osdell, and that's John Manley.
This podcast is sponsored by Wintrust. Don't use your money as rolling papers. Be smart with it. Wintrust can help. Go to Wintrust.com.
So this week, it is a roundtable on Chicago in the 1990s, and we're joined by a handful of artists who were there and who had a big impact. Louise Post of Veruca Salt, Scott Lucas of Local H, and Josh Caterer of Smoking Popes. And to begin, let's start broad. We'll work our way down into the inside baseball sort of stuff. Who was the best, or who was your favorite artist of that era? And we'll start with Louise.
It started as the Smashing Pumpkins and I fell in love with Exile in Guyville despite not wanting to, I fell in love with it. Scott's in the room. I have to say, you know, we all adore Triple Fast Action like nobody's business. And of course, Local H, and of course, Menthol, the underappreciated Menthol. I think that's it.
Scott, besides your own band, who else were your favorite Chicago bands?
Smoking Popes, Veruca Salt. I really like Red Red Meat a lot. And I did one of these things before, and I forgot all about Jimmy Wine Majestic. And Menthol is another band that doesn't get talked about. And another great band that I absolutely loved was Muchacha.
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys know Falstaff? They spin off of Shrimp Boat, the Sea and Cake in Falstaff.
Yeah. Yep. I remember Falstaff. They were great.
I love Falstaff.
That was Ian, the dude who makes his own guitars.
Ian Schneller.
That's it.
Ian Schneller, specimen guitarist. Yeah, shout out to Ian.
Song that I absolutely love that was stuck in my head for years that went, one more cup of coffee. You remember that song?
No, oh, yeah. You're singing it.
Yeah. It had this super heavy riff in it.
I went to their shows. I had the records, and they had a song called Home. Do you know that one? So beautiful.
Sing it.
I'll stop talking, but I loved Red Red Meat. I forgot. They were kind of like, you know, biblical to me or something. So
I remember one of the first times I interviewed Veruca Salt, we were talking about local music. And at the time, Louise, you and Nina told me, like, you explained Jimmy Wine Majestic to me. I think at that particular moment in time, you were caught in the throes of that album, and you went on and on about how great that album. You helped make me a fan of Red Red Meat.
Oh, wow. I thought she explained the title to you and what that meant. Jimmy
Josh,
Wine Majestic.
Josh, who are your standouts from that period?
I liked all the previously mentioned bands, but I also was a really big fan of what Urge Overkill was doing. Their early records particularly were just great. And when Saturation came out, I spent a lot of time with that. I put them at the top of the Chicago list.
Still probably the best sounding record that came out of that whole era. It just sounds amazing.
Yeah, it really does.
Let's start at the beginning of like the Chicago explosion or whatever you want to call it. Where was cool? Who was cool? And what band did everyone want to be? Like who blazed the trail for real? Like who was the band that everybody was kind of looking at going, I want to do that? Well, Scott, let's start with you.
I was kind of like when all that stuff started, I was still living in Zion. So I was kind of reading about these guys, including Louise and Josh, like in The Reader. So like everybody was cool from me. And so I was kind of starting, but still kind of on the outside. So, I mean, I just wanted to move to Chicago and get out of Zion, but you know, seeing bands like the Jesus Lizard and all that stuff that was going on with Touch and Go. I mean, I didn't really know where to go. You know, I'd go to Lounge Acts. Lounge Acts seemed really cool to me. Like, I guess to answer your question, Lounge Acts was pretty cool.
Louise, what about you?
Well, I remember when Scott came from Zion, we're like, who's this guy now? What's this band now? And we used to all bowl together. We had like a local band bowling league. I'm so sorry that you weren't a part of that league, Josh. We used to sometimes, well, every Tuesday night, we all got together and bowled, like the members of Fig Dish, Loud Lucy, Local H, Baruch Assault. I can't remember who else. Triple Fast, maybe Menthol.
Maybe we could reassemble the league.
Well, I'm in LA, so that'd be kind of hard. But next,
you know, Zoom. They have Zoom bowling.
Zoom bowling. You've really hit on something.
But yeah, I mean, Lounge X was the top of the mountain. Like, if you could play Lounge X, that was the coolest place to play. Like, once you play there, you're kind of, why bother with anything else, you know? I guess Metro might surpass it a little. Yeah. But Lounge X was really, really cool. And I was just wanted to say about Urge Overkill that they were, we played a show with them at University of Chicago before we'd ever met them. We played with Yum Yum. At Savile and Glitz, I think it was, and pre-Yum Yum, it was Chris Holmes's band, and Urge Overkill headlined, and we were so, Nina and I were so overwhelmed by how to sing harmonies on key live. It was always our hardest thing, because our band was so loud, we're always trying to hear ourselves. It's still the problem. I mean, it's one of those things that never goes away, and even with in-ears, it's like, ugh, we're off key. But we listened to Eddie and Nash. We were just blown away by how perfectly in the pocket their harmonies were live. We were like, how do we do that? That's what we want to do. It was so beautiful the way they sang together, so naturally and so in tune.
Well,
they were really
pros. The worm has certainly turned on that, hasn't it? I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, have you heard them sing together recently?
No.
You guys do a much better job. Just let's leave it at that.
Thank you. You tell Nina that, okay?
Okay. I'll tell her.
Josh, what do you think it was about Chicago at that time that fostered such a wonderful music scene and kind of this creative explosion of really great bands all coming from the same place?
What was it? Well, I mean, it was right behind, just a couple years behind what was happening on the West Coast. So you had, you know, Nirvana, Green Day, and that whole transition where punk music suddenly became mainstream. And then, I don't know if the music industry folks were looking everywhere and they decided that Chicago had the best batch of bands or what, but it did seem for just divinely orchestrated reasons that there was an unusually rich crop of talented bands all, you know, concentrated in Chicago at that time.
And bowlers apparently too.
And bowlers. I think the two things go together.
Well, I think what was so interesting about that time, I mean, Louise mentioned Savile and Glitz, which was this weird, freaky space rock group. We had this ascendant punk rock scene. You had these straight ahead rock bands from Urge to Triple Fast. It was all these different styles, and everyone just knew each other, played with each other. There wasn't any siloing between bands, maybe in the punk rock community a little bit more. Punk was in its own universe in some respects, but this was a scene that allowed Wesley Willis to become a national name. Like, it seemed like anything could happen during that time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it seemed like it was pretty organic, especially if you compare it to, you know, I was talking about what happened on the West Coast. Like, That's not to say that Nirvana and Green Day weren't organic bands, but I think the West Coast scene was maybe a little more, there's much more of an industry presence there. So bands would come up with kind of an awareness of that. And there was more of a focus on like potentially marketing niches that bands could fall into. Whereas Chicago was just, we didn't have that. We were just a bunch of sort of grassroots musicians just doing it.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
I'm done.
I just was going to say, in addition to that, that we were, it was all very innocent at the time. It, like, I can say for myself that I grew up worshiping bands and album covers and, you know, studying Abbey Road and studying Rumors and like memorizing these pictures. And just, it was my first dream was being in a band. And as far as where bands came from, it was like they came from Planet Rock. They didn't come from some boardroom. They didn't come from anywhere in particular, you know. I remember hearing that I loved Styx when I was in junior high or sixth grade. I remember hearing that they came from Chicago, and I was like, what? No, they're from Planet Rock, definitely, and Journey and stuff. But they're but yeah, I just think it was a really innocent time. And like, I still felt that way. Like, I loved the Pixies. I wanted to make a Pixies record. And then I found out about, you know, Nirvana wanting to be the Pixies. And, you know, we loved Nirvana. We loved My Bloody Valentine and certainly the Breeders' Pod and all these bands that were out in the ether, right, that were influencing us, but they weren't in our scene necessarily. The fact that our scene was such this, like Josh was saying, this really, I think, pool of talented people was really remarkable. And then I remember hearing that Brendan O'Brien somebody found, it wasn't Brendan O'Brien was the producer, but somebody found the members of Pearl Jam and like pieced them together. And that was so foreign to me and so sort of fake, you know, I remember hearing that Billy and Billy Corgan met Darcy at the, you know, in line at an Avalon show on the way in to see some show and asked her to play with him. And that's just how we form bands. And, you know, keeping it real in Chicago, we didn't have, everything was very organic.
How fast did that all change? Like, once the labels and the industry kind of swooped in, did it stay pure, for lack of a better term, Scott, or did it flip fast? Like this, like the Seattle scene where you had your core group of bands who were legitimately bands that came up and were bands forever, and then you kind of had that second wave of like commercialism come in. How did that flip fast here?
I think that depends on where you were sitting when all that, or standing or whatever, when all that stuff was happening. Like, you know, we can talk about how innocent and how, you know, we weren't insular and not closed off, and that sounds right to us, but to other people, like bands who, you know, couldn't get a record deal or couldn't get attention or couldn't get written about, they're like, that's not the way I fucking remember it. Like, I remember, like, you guys were assholes and you didn't let us on your bills and you didn't invite us to your bowling parties and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of pettiness and jealousy going on. But, you know, when you're 20 and dumb, you don't really care about anybody else's feelings. So I'm certainly not in a point to make a judgment on it.
Sure. Josh, how did you guys get signed? Do you remember the story? Like, what happened?
Yeah. For us, it had to do with Green Day, who we were kind of discussing before the interview got rolling. But they played a vital part in launching us into it, because the two guys that were managing Green Day decided to start a record label at the time. And we were the first band that they called, because the guys in Green Day had been talking about us when they came through town on their Dookie tour. They asked us to open for them. And so we were one of the bands that they had sort of given some press at the time. And so their managers called us to invite us to be the first band on their new label that they were starting up, which we did not end up signing with that label. But the fact that we'd been contacted by them just started this wave of, it just put us in the ring. So
did you meet them when they were playing at McGregor's or something?
I saw them play at McGregor's, but no, we played with them at, it was the Riv. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And that was funny because we found out that we got that gig because we looked in the Illinois Entertainer and we saw a show listing that said Green Day with special guests Smoking Popes. And that was the first we heard about it. So, but we knew the guy who booked there and we contacted him and we were like, what's going on? Like, there's a misprint in the paper. Like, it says we're opening for Green Day. And he's like, oh no, they asked for you guys. And I figured there's no way you would say no to it. So I just went ahead and put your name on it.
You were like, okay, just ask me next time. Okay. You know, I don't like to be broadsided by this kind of crap.
Or at least tell us when we're supposed to be there. Right.
Right. Yeah. Like at what point were we supposed to advance the show? If we hadn't seen the ad, there were a lot of unanswered questions there.
Speaking of origin stories, Louise, I remember the beginnings of Veruca Salt happening very quickly. It felt like things happened really fast for the band. Am I remembering it correctly? Or I guess tell your origin story.
Yeah, they happened. Once we started playing, things happened really crazy fast. But the impression was like we came out of nowhere. And we were always defensive about, and I guess I still am, about the fact that we were working on our songs and working on creating who we were together, like for a year and a half before we even played with Steve Black, our bass player. So Nina and I really were indoors for such a long time, just working and becoming better, getting to know each other, falling in sync and doing open mics and things like that. And then once we were, we had a demo and I went around and shopped our cassette tape we made in Hyde Park with somebody's friend's boyfriend in his basement, you know, and I went around and shopped it and I brought it to like Avalon and Lounge Rax and Beat Kitchen and Elbow Room and the Czar Bar. And I met with the booker and I made an appointment and I followed up and I dropped off this cassette. And then, you know, we got a show at some of these places and very quickly we were asked to be on a compilation, Chicago compilation. And then within three shows, we got signed by Jim Powers from Minty Fresh. He had tried to sign Liz Phair to Zoo and they had passed on her. And so he started his own label, Minty Fresh. And I think we were his first signing or second. And so we didn't know what was happening. We're like, oh yeah, okay. And we were going to do a 7-inch with him, but it turned into like a bigger deal. And we were just going to do 7-inch with Brad Wood, but we had so many songs that it turned into a full length. And Brad was someone whose work I loved so much. He had worked with Seam and Red Red Meat and Hum, also great bands. And I forgot to mention the Cupcakes. They just need to be mentioned. Sorry. So we were already like on our way with Brad Wood and Minty Fresh when we put out Seether as a 7-inch and we didn't have time to finish our record because we had allotted 2 weeks. And I don't know what bands can record in 2 weeks, but it wasn't us. So we would go on the road and then we'd come back in and do like 2 weeks and then leave and come back and do like 3 days. And we pieced together American Thighs. And in the meantime, put out a 7-inch of Seether and a song called All Hail Me on the back and played South by Southwest. And it was like, all of a sudden things were just exploding. Like we were playing in this tent because the venue had burned down and it seemed like every single label was there. It was just the place to be. And it was a very strange year. It was really surreal. I think we thought that's what the world would be like from now on, you know, and we were just wined and dined by every label. And as it turned out, we didn't sign where we wanted to sign because Geffen had bought up Minty Fresh and done a deal with Jim Powers. So we formed all these relationships with these people from all these various labels, and we ended up going with Geffen, which was of course a great place to be at the time. And that's how that happened.
Hey, what was the name of that venue in Austin that had burned down? Do you remember?
Electric Factory. That's Philadelphia, isn't it?
Because I had like with the Pope had like a similar experience in Austin, where we showed up for a gig we were supposed to play, and the club had burned down. And I'm assuming, like, how often does that happen in Austin? Maybe a lot, but I'm assuming it might be the same place.
You got opening for Green Day?
Was it the same show? Was it the same show, Josh? Were we playing the?
I don't think so. I think this was. Like this was a tour that we were doing with the Boll Weevils back in the like 91 or two.
Okay. Yeah. You guys predated us. You were like sophomores when we were freshmen. I think honestly, it's like, oh God, Anina would know it, but I can't remember. We have selective memories, and she has certain things and I have other things, but I even have a picture of us standing by the sign, like somebody, you know, hand painted a sign because there was no sign. So it was an interesting time, but I don't know if it was the same place. I think this place had burned down the night before or something crazy like that.
Well, I like that idea, Louise, that you were talking about how you thought that this was where it was going to be forever. You know, I mean, that to me kind of like sums up that whole era for me. It's like, all right, this is it. This is the career, or this is how it's going to go with every record. And you know what I mean? That like really, that's what that whole era feels like to me. It's like, all right, I've arrived, and you know, people are going to treat every record that we put out like this. And you know, it wasn't long till, you know, you were disabused of that notion.
That's right. And did you guys both experience the famous Chicago backlash?
The backlash about having signed?
Yeah, having signed, having a degree of success. Chicago, like, famously eats their young, you know?
Not really. They were, you guys got, Brook Assault, you guys got that way more than anybody else did. Like,
we got it is the worst. That's because we're women.
Always,
you know?
Were children for that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think that's true.
Yeah. You and Liz Phair, like, I'd go to your shows, and half the audience was just bitching about, they're not that good. And I'm like, then why are you here? Like, get out of here.
I do remember that was a very palpable thing back in the 90s, this concern about having sold out.
That was the most 90s thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember feeling that, not necessarily in the form of things that people were saying directly to us, but just being self-conscious about it. Like, I remember this show that we played at the Fireside Bowl after we signed, and just being, especially that was the first tour that we ever did in a bus. And so to have a bus parked outside the Fireside Bowl,
I think it's going to get egged.
I was just very self-conscious about that, and felt like I just was like, people were just going to turn on me at any moment. You know, they didn't, but like, I was worried about it.
Well, it does seem like the punk rock community was way more sensitive about artists signing to major labels than anyone else. I mean, that was like a blatant violation of the purity test.
It's such a weird thing too. Like now, you know, dealing with new artists like I do on a daily basis, it's such a weird thing because they have none of that fear of being labeled a sellout or impurity. They like lead the way with, oh, I'm trying to be famous. I have 7 billion, you know, YouTube hits. And it's like, you know, as someone from the 90s, I guess you would say, it's like very like shocking to hear people just brazenly come out and go like, yeah, this is the goal. And it's like, no, you can't say that. You got to be cool. You know, and it's an interesting generational thing when you hear it, because it's such a different mindset. And I'm not saying it's bad or better or worse. It's just, it's definitely a culture shock moment when you see the bands that are like, oh no, we want this.
As I can't decide if it's better or worse. Like, there are ways in which I think back in the 90s, we were overly inhibited by that and sort of it was an unnecessary burden. But at the same time, it's good to have a little bit of like artistic integrity.
Yeah, you know? It's good to have a little integrity. I think bands a little bit of
artistic integrity. Yeah.
That needs to be a t-shirt.
Can you pull the ambition back a little? Like, just give it a second before you start putting out Coke commercials. Yeah.
I like the riff, but I need a little more integrity, please.
Yeah. I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I don't think that's anything to apologize for. And this whole idea that, you know, that people from the 90s were too sensitive about that. Maybe it's true, but I still think by and large, it's bullshit. And this whole thing that's like, oh, like getting people patting you on the head. Oh, that's so cute that you guys cared about your integrity and you didn't just say, fuck it and take all the money. I find that really insulting. And that kind of wasn't what it was about. Like, this idea that we had something and it couldn't be co-opted right away, you know, at least not right away. At least it took a few years. I think that was something important to hold on to. And the idea that nobody cares about that anymore really bugs me.
I don't disagree. It's a weird phenomenon. And I just like to blame the internet whenever I don't know how to put something in
sure.
the proper perspective. I just say it's the internet's fault.
It's everything is their fault.
Right, exactly. But let's talk about that for a second. Like, so when was the moment that you're on a stage somewhere and you're like, ah, oh, shit, this is we've gone too far now, or like this is kind of crumbling around us, like the scene, not so much particularly you guys, but like you get put in a place where you start to see like the shine is wearing off a little bit of the scene. Did you guys ever have a moment like that where you're kind of, when did you become aware of it, I guess? Scott, we'll start with you.
I think for me, like just seeing Capitol Records treatment of all of my friends' bands was the first time where I was like, this is all a lie, you know? So like within a year, seeing them sit on records by Triple Fast Action and Menthol and the Smoking Popes and all but bury those records, it just seemed like Capitol had it out for Chicago bands. I mean, did you recognize that happening at all, Josh? It seemed like all of you were getting taken out at the same time.
At the time, and I guess in retrospect, I still somewhat feel this way that as far as our band was concerned, a lot of those problems were of our own making, like our behavior and my behavior specifically was not particularly cooperative with the label. And so I always felt like I kind of soured that and made them not particularly excited about, wanting to work with us. And maybe that was born out of that like deep self-consciousness about selling out. So I would refuse to do all this like promotional stuff that they wanted us to do. And they just got sick of that after a while. I don't know if, you know, like the guys in Menthol or Triple Fast were taking that same approach or if they were more,
who knows? I mean, they wanted to sign a rock band. They wanted to sign, you know, a snotty punk rock band.
Yeah. So the idea was they've got all this money. They're just going to sign up all these bands. And if one of them kind of rises to the top, they're going to forget everybody else and just invest in them.
Right. But like if you show up and you've got an attitude and they go, hey, whoa, what's with this attitude? And it's like, no, you paid for this attitude, right? And now you don't want to work with us? It's like, I think you paid for the wrong thing.
Right. I thought you wanted a tortured artist.
Yeah.
We've mentioned a lot of bands' names who are not household names at this point. Triple Fast Action came up, and it's worth mentioning there was a vinyl re-release of their independent album, Cattlemen Don't, that came out earlier this year. Spectacular album. Scott Lucas, one of our panelists today, wrote some of the best liner notes I've ever read on a record for that particular release. Love that. But I guess this begs the question, of all those bands, signed or not, who should have gone farther? Who should have been pushed into the stratosphere during that period? Was it Triple Fast? Should they have been?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think Cattlemen Don't is one of the best records that of the 90s that, and one of the best records that came out of Chicago for sure. I also thought Balthazar Delay was a brilliant songwriter. That Menthol record is one of my all-time favorite records. He's such a poet. So
I was just listening to that record like a few weeks ago. And you remember that song on there called Strange Living?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is such a brilliant song. The lyrics are incredible for that song. Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
Stress Is Best is the one that kills me. Is that what you just said, good. Scott? Oh, my God.
What's the
You can't even find that record. Is it anywhere? I had to dig up that song somewhere.
It's in Scott's living room is where it is.
Yeah.
I know. Thank God for Scott.
I can't find it. It's next to that Green Day record.
It's incredible. So for of all the bands that there we go.
Yeah. Nice. James coming through.
Thank you
Does
very
it still
much.
Have the promo sticker on it?
How dare you? No, it has the bullet holes at the bottom.
Oh, good.
No sticker. Yeah.
Good. Good.
Or the drill holes.
Uh-huh.
So we can't possibly do a 90s Chicago alt podcast without bringing up the elephant and the infinite sorrow in the room, Smashing Pumpkins. I think they're such an interesting conflicting band as far as being a part of the scene and being the poster children kind of the movement, whether it was justified or deserved or not. Louise, what are your thoughts on Smashing Pumpkins?
I think Gish is a masterpiece. It's one of my favorite records. And
that album still holds up really well to this day, too. I think it sounds better now than it did then, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah, go back. It's really good now.
Okay.
I mean, it's really good then, too, obviously, but like...
Did he do a re-release, a vinyl re-release, like some years ago? I remember my friend was playing bass with him, and we were at her wedding, and he was telling me that he was going to do a vinyl re-release of Gish, but I didn't follow through. At any rate, I loved Gish. I thought they were so cool. I remember seeing them on the front of the Illinois Entertainer. And then it happened that where my cafe, where I always went for coffee, was the place where Darcy worked, and James would come in and they'd play chess, and she painted the bathroom, and they were just these really cool people who were really just interesting to me, intriguing people. And then I saw them on the front of the Illinois Entertainer, and when the record came out, I got it right away, and it just blew my mind. And then some, you know, they changed with the next album, as bands do, and the songwriting didn't go away. They stayed, I think, super cool and intact. But Gish is, I guess, I'm sort of like a purist snob in my own right, and I really just always go back to that record. Just like I love Nothing's Shocking by Jane's Addiction, I always go back to that, and Bleach, and you know, so on. But yeah, I love them. I really looked up to them. I love them. They always seemed like a little outside of what I knew to be the Chicago scene, like the big kids again, like they were kind of the seniors, you know? Yeah. But I did become friendly with them over time and got to know them a bit, you know?
Scott, do they help you guys out at all? I mean, I think of like the Seattle scene where, you know, Chris Cornell was kind of the center of the universe up there and kind of did his part to keep everyone around and, you know, bring everybody with. And I guess as an outsider perspective, I don't get that vibe about the Pumpkins.
No.
Is that right?
I think that by the time we arrived, the Pumpkins were kind of like, we don't want to be a Chicago band, we don't want to be lumped in the Chicago thing. They wanted to be international, because they were. So, you know, for me, I didn't even meet any of them until, you know, a few years ago. So they weren't even in my stratosphere. Like, it was just like, oh yeah, those guys are part of something that I'm not a part of. I never felt like that they were a Chris Cornell or anything, you know. I mean, I did. They were next. Ask Josh.
Josh Caterer. Smashing Pumpkins. Discuss.
I've never met any of the Smashing Pumpkins, which actually I'm sort of surprised that I didn't, especially in the 90s, given the fact that we had a lot of mutual acquaintances and that, you know, both bands were spending a lot of time at the Metro, and both bands were working with Joe Shanahan. We were managed by Joe Shanahan all through the 90s, who I understand is pretty close friends with Billy and all of those guys. So, but we were never introduced. So I didn't have any personal experiences with them at all. Other than that, I saw them open. This was, I don't know what year this was, but it was, I saw them open for the Buzzcocks at the Metro, right when the Buzzcocks first got back together, and it was all the original lineup. And man, that was an incredible show.
And what did they sound like? What did Smashing Pumpkins sound like?
That was like the first time I hadn't heard of them before. Uh-huh. So that was my first introduction to them musically. And so I guess as time went on, then I noticed that as I would hear them, you know, on the radio and things, I would be like, oh, I remember that band, but they didn't sound like this. So right. Their sound kind of evolved, and it seemed like they were trying to look for something that was going to perhaps be more marketable or something, because they weren't that way at the beginning.
Well, when I first saw them in Milwaukee, I think it was, they sounded like The Cure. And the legend has it is they opened up for Louise just mentioned them, Jane's Addiction. And then after that show, everything changed. Like, they were just like, all right, we don't want to sound like The Cure anymore. We're going to sound like this. And they started writing kick-ass riffs and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was just wondering, did they sound like The Cure when you saw them?
I can't remember. I was there to see the Buzzcocks, man.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
You politely endure the opening band.
One of the bands.
I live out here in LA, and which we used to call the Bucktown of the West, Wicker Park of the West, sorry, Silver Lake and Echo Park, et cetera. But I ran into James Iha at one of my favorite restaurants where I always go with my daughter, and he was with his family and hadn't seen him in ages. And we were pretty good friends at one point, and I just lost touch with him. And then sometime soon after that, I went to go see the newest, what was it? I guess it was the newest version of the Pumpkins, although my friend was no longer playing. And I heard through the grapevine that James was going to come out on stage. And this is the first time. I mean, the last time I saw Billy, he was like, he was telling me about all this legal stuff between him and James, and he was still so pissed off. And I'm like, how can you live with all this rage? How can you live with it? I cannot live with it. I cannot live with that kind of resentment. It's got to go, you know? And he's like, oh man, I just like to hold on to it. I just like to hold on to that. And so anyway, so that's kind of the nature of what was going on with them at the time. And years later, I went to the Ace Hotel to see the Pumpkins. And James came out on stage, and it was like the entire place got to their feet and started screaming. And it went on. It just didn't stop. And James was just standing there awkwardly like, hey. And it was very sweet. It brought tears to my eyes, you know, because that's the kind of impact that they had on people. And that's the kind of impact that a band of origin has on people, you know. And I mean, I obviously know something about that. Just coming back together after so many years of acrimony is really powerful and has, you know, ripples and is more symbolic of healing than one can really imagine, you know? So it was a really big moment. I thought I would just mention it. And of course, James has stayed with Billy for some time now.
A band that I think has been swallowed up by history and doesn't get enough credit is Material Issue. That big album, International Pop Overthrow, came out the same year as Gish. And I think had Jim Ellison not taken his own life, I think that band probably had brighter days ahead. But it seems like they've been left out of the conversation by and large as time has marched on.
Yeah, like they were just ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Scott, go ahead.
No, it's all right. It's like Material Issue was just ahead of that explosion. So like their timing was, I mean, you know, they had done really well, and they were favorites of the city, and you know, they had MTV hits before anybody, but they were just before that whole Nirvana explosion. So they're completely, the timing was just a little bit off for them. But I think you're right. If Jim was still here, there would definitely be a point where it would come back around, and you know, they'd be headlining Riot Fest or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that he had the songwriting chops to where their stuff would have endured, and they would have been taken seriously not only commercially but artistically, you know.
Yep.
I mean, Catherine too was another band that was really good and like super like right on the verge of getting big, and they were, I mean, I think you were more peers with them, Josh, like you both came out around the same time. I think they were established when we got there, as were you.
Yeah, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine had the Smashing Pumpkins halo around them as well. They were part of the Pumpkins extended family. I think that helped
right. Open
some doors.
They were in the Pumpkinverse.
Exactly.
We went bowling with the Pumpkins.
Yeah, bowling with the Pumpkins. Isn't that a Camper Van Beethoven song?
That is. Absolutely.
Take the Pumpkins bowling? Correct, yeah.
Well, that Material Issue record, that first one was recorded in Zion. And the second one. I just get Zion.
Represent.
I had made a joke earlier on my Facebook about I was doing this podcast and I was so excited to, you know, I went deep diving into all these great 90s Chicago bands, and someone was quick to go, well, the band you mentioned is actually from Champaign at first. And my response was, I grew up in Milwaukee, so everybody was downstate for me.
Right.
But when you look back on, you know, that whole era of music and that time in this great city, let's go around the room. What is like your summary, your tweet length review of that era? What did it mean to you? What does it mean forever? Louise, we'll start with you.
Oh, really? That's not fair. that's too much. What does it mean to me? And what will it mean forever?
Yeah. Like, what's your tweet length review of the 90s in Chicago?
Are you counting characters as she goes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on it. Yeah.
Can you come back to me?
Sure.
Who's ready for that?
Josh, you want to take it? Go for it.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to want to go first here, but for me, I think it's all kind of summed up by something that we were talking about a little while ago. The idea was mentioned that that at the time it seemed like it was going to be like that forever. And we lived those years as if it would always go on that way, which sort of made them strangely exuberant and reckless and semi self-destructive, you know. And now looking back, it just seems like an anomaly, just this strange time. It hit like a tidal wave and you know, then moved on and just left us, you know, there gasping for air on the beach. But you know, I think that, and this is way longer than a tweet. Okay, that was...
You're good. You're fine. You're good. You're good.
That was a tweet thread.
Yeah. It's a tweet thread. Yeah, this is like, you know, 4 out of 14. Is that, you know, looking back on it, like, it's one thing to think about what was going on at the time and what was it like to experience that, and what did our career look like and how were the shows? There's that. And then there's this other thing, which is the music, the actual records that we were making. And I feel like the reason why people are still interested in talking about the 90s and Chicago alternative 90s music is because some enduring records were made during that time. And there was something about the mixture of ingredients, like all the money and attention that was thrown at Chicago at a group of people who all were like desperately trying to cling to their artistic integrity. You know, you've put those things together and what you have are a bunch of records that sound really good, but that actually had some substance to them. And I think that's all stuff we can be really proud of, you know, like for our band, you know, I look back on those and I'm like, you know, all the crazy stuff that was happening at that time. I'm glad that now we have these albums that come out of it that I can still feel good about playing that music all these years later.
All right, Scott, your tweet thread.
Everything Josh said. I agree with everything he said. Louise, next.
Cop out.
I was looking at Josh's arms while he was talking, and I was thinking,
"So was
that
I. They're spectacular."
That I have
the gun show that you got going on is amazing.
Yeah,
I was thinking that Chicago in the '90s is like a beautiful tattoo. Like even if you want to get rid of it, you can't. It's always a part of you. That's my succinct answer. But Chicago was home to me. You know, I really found my home there. I found home with my band. It was like my new family. And then I found an extended family. And it was the most exciting time. It was the most fun, I don't know, I'd ever had. It was incredible. And then like Josh, you know, alluded to, the dead fish image. We were all, I think, you know, we really sort of stunned by what was happening all at once. And we were mortally wounded by the aforementioned backlash. You know, I remember going to the empty bottle bathroom. Of course, we can't have this podcast without mentioning the empty bottle. And it was like we got back from tour and we were so excited to play the bottle. And we were doing sound check and Nina goes in the bathroom and she sees Veruca Salt sucks with an X and on the graffiti on the wall. And then it says Nina sucks, but Louise is cool. that's how we were welcomed home. You know, I thought, well, at least I'm cool. But we were just like widely loathed for having had any success on the same record and songs that people had loved us for like 5 minutes prior. So we were so shocked. Our, you know, one of Chicago's own, Fred Armisen, is a friend of ours and was then and is now. And he said, he told us that, yeah, we were friends with him then, but he worked at Urbis Orbis, if you guys remember that cafe. And Jim and I were sitting there doing flyers because we put up our flyers everywhere and we played a show. I think we might have had a song on MTV at that point. And I remember, you know, Fred just told us, yeah, I thought you guys had sold out. Like everybody did. It was like the thing. And we were so hurt to have the indie elite in Chicago turn their back on us. Not that we were ever trying to be indie elite, but it was so quick that we were loved and thrown aside. And then ultimately, like, Chicago broke my heart. Like, it really broke my heart. I had to leave, you know? It just, I miss it, and I, you know, I pine for it. And for those times, during quarantine, I've been thinking a lot about these times. I've been looking at old pictures. I'm doing writing that involves that time and listening to music from that time. But, like, it really did. It really broke my heart. And so when I think to that time, I have only joy, like, only joy. But then I am also, like, very aware of how it turned, you know? And how I think that happened for a lot of bands. I think that might have been a bit of a universal experience.
Well, as someone who was discovering music right at the time that you guys were making it, up in Wisconsin, like I said, I do want to thank you guys all for making Chicago sound like the coolest place in the frickin' world and for making me want to ditch school and jump on an Amtrak and come down and buy records and hunt down Wesley Willis and try to get in Local H and convince Liz Phair to marry me. All of these things were so formative, and it's, I just want to thank you guys, because literally everything that I did after that was to try to sound like I was from Chicago. And that's due to you guys. So thank you so much for inadvertently planting a seed, which got me to this place, which I still don't even believe it's real, but we're here. And thank you guys, seriously.
Thank you. And I mean, believe it or not, that was the goal, to get you to take the train down to Chicago and try to do all those things. That really was, I mean, honestly.
It totally was. It's just the idea that girls, so many legions of girls have come up to us and said, you got me starting playing guitar, is the biggest honor I could ever imagine, you know, because I just wanted to be the guitar players I loved and the singers I loved. And, you know, it's like that, you hold onto a hand and you put one forth, we're all so connected. And to be a part of that fabric is really an honor. To have people know who my band is an honor. You know, I keep thinking that nobody knows who we are. And like, then someone will say, oh my God, Ruby Salt, I love your band. And I'm like, oh wow. I just forget, you know? So it's to be a part of this podcast. Chicago and rock and roll brought me to Scott. We had a long-term friendship, and it's, sorry guys. it's been hello. I still have a landline. Okay.
Oh my God.
Wow.
I know why. Well, no, here's why.
I'm so because 90s.
I can't not have one, because I feel like, you know, if there were there an earthquake, I live in like the land of fire and damnation, hell of fire and damnation. That if there were an earthquake or like some natural disaster, I'd have to have a landline, until I realized that it's all part of my cable. So it's really useless and pointless to have. But anyway, honestly, like, it was like one of the greatest times of my life. And I'm still having the greatest time of my life. It was just different. And I think I know that Lucas and I had a blast, and I wish I had known Josh better back in the day.
I'm still mad about this bowling thing.
I still have memories. Back in the day, I used to do a Christmas show every year, a radio Christmas show. And one of the very few, I guess, Veruca Salt Smoking Pope's crossovers, I remember Josh was there, and Louise, you were there with Nina. And that's Josh was doing a holiday song. And I remember at one point, Josh was singing, and we all know what Josh's voice can do to people. And I caught Nina's eyes, and she caught mine, and she just put her hand over her heart and mouth. Like, I remember that so clearly, just that Veruca Salt Smoking Pope's crossover moment where the power of Josh just overtook Nina Gordon.
He sounds like an angel.
Yes. the power of the voice.
I'm so sorry. That is something that we do, and we talk about this. We put, it's the hand over the heart moment. It only happens when we are so moved by something. And I'll say to her, like, you did a hand over the heart, you know, because that's when it is something that is so incredible that you can't help but put your hand over your heart and like, so.
Well, I know none of us want to live in nostalgia forever. So before we cut you all loose, and you've been incredibly generous with your time, let's talk about the future. Starting with Scott, Local H's most recent album, Lifers, is out. And you decided that being in a band wasn't lucrative enough, so you decided to start a podcast.
I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you, James.
So that's where the real money is.
Yeah, that's where
I've got some bad news for you.
Yeah. So what's your podcast called?
It's called the Lifers Podcast, and it just started yesterday. Or was it the day? It started yesterday. And we just interviewed Juliana Hatfield for the next episode last night, and that'll go on tomorrow. And Louise and Josh, I'm coming for you two next. So keep it up.
I'm there.
Right, I'm in. Let's do it.
All right.
So Louise, Veruca resurfaced a few years ago. What's the current status of Veruca Salt?
We're on hiatus. And, you know, we live in different places. And
why are you on hiatus?
Why are we?
Yeah, why? What's going on? Why are you?
You're going to have to talk to Nina about that.
Well, it's got nothing to do with COVID.
Nothing to do with COVID. Okay. Oh, that. Yeah, just COVID. But, you know, Jim's in Chicago. Steve's is pretty local. He's in Oceanside, but we're working on some other things together. We have a podcast in the works. We have something else we're working on with another person, a writer. So we're working on various things, but not a record right now. I'm writing like crazy. I don't know if it's going to end up being Veruca Salt material or Louise Post solo material. I also have a side project going on, a band I started with some friends that I'll probably release this year. So I'm really like artistically, creatively on fire right now. And I'm going to be putting stuff out in various forms in like the next year or two.
And you mentioned Jim Shapiro from the band. The one way I know to contact Jim Shapiro, it's kind of like his bat signal. If I just put anything about Todd Rundgren on the internet, he will somehow hone in on it and respond. That's the easiest way to track him down. Josh Caterer, solo album on the way soon, yes?
Yeah, I've got a solo album called The Hideout Sessions. It's coming out next month on Pravda Records. And it's called The Hideout Sessions because it was recorded live on stage at The Hideout. Sort of a live show. I mean, it's a live performance, but there was no audience there. We did a virtual show last October, recorded it, and are releasing it as a semi-live album.
That's so cool. I can't wait to hear it.
It was super fun to do. And we enjoyed it so much that we're already planning another one.
Volume 2.
Volume 2, yeah.
Love it. Guys, girls, thank you for your contributions. Reconnecting with you all, it really warms my heart. And I don't say that facetiously. It's a delight seeing and talking to you all.
And you too, James. It's always so good to see you. Thanks for asking us.
Thanks for putting this together. It's been a blast.
Yeah, it was a great way to spend an afternoon.
The History of Alternative podcast is recorded at the 101 WKQX studios in Chicago. Subscribe on Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't do drugs. Stay in school.